Take a network break. Find a quiet place to have a virtual donut and a hot beverage and join us for our weekly analysis of tech news. Today's show is sponsored in part by VMware and its Virtual Cloud Network Deep Dive. You can hear from VMware NSX product experts on how to grow your skills to create an agile, programmable network infrastructure that can meet the business and security demands of the multi-cloud world. Visit vmware.com/go/VCNDeepDive to register. That's vmware.com/go/VCNDeepDive. All right, let's get into the news. Cisco Systems has taken another step into hardware and software disaggregation. The company has started shipping the Nexus 9336C. This is a 100-gig leaf switch that supports SAI. That's the switch abstraction interface so that you can run third-party network OSs.
Yeah, so how the wheel turns. So Cisco, yeah. Which originally refused to acknowledge that disaggregation was occurring and that white box and merchant silicon was the way forward. And a couple of years down the pipeline, what do we see?
We see giant cloud companies saying, we want you to disaggregate.
Yeah, we were. And so they are. So Cisco makes a lot of noise about being a customer-led company, you know, being customer-driven, because that's where they get their innovation from, is customers instead of doing it themselves, perhaps. But I think that, you know, 36 ports of 100 gig, this is basically the latest generation of chips that we've seen. Now, this is built on a cloud-scale ASIC, which is Cisco's own. But you might also note that 36 ports of 100 gig is pretty close to what everybody else is running. I think most of them are 32, aren't they? Most of the Jerichos are 32 ports of 100 gig.
Yes. Yeah, 36 is a strange...
Ours goes to 11.
That's right.
We do four more, therefore it must be better.
That's right.
For some people, that's possibly also true. There's also some interesting things there. They make a big deal about smart buffers for AI ML use cases requiring low latency Rocky. I don't actually think that most AI ML uses Rocky, but for those who do, that's a good thing. Smart buffers means when you peg the bandwidth right to the peak, you don't drop your buffering as far as you can, so microbursts are handled where that matters. And then, of course, Cisco's cloud-scale ASIC keeps banging on about it's got special magic features for telemetry capabilities. If that's your thing, you might also want to consider P4-based devices like the Tofino, which do even have much better industry-leading telemetry capabilities. But I think the biggest thing here, of course, is the SAI ASIC abstraction. So that means anybody can bring their operating system to this hardware.
I believe they're testing that they've got SAI, but they're also testing with Sonic, they were saying, at a telecom infrastructure project initiative.
Yeah, well, Sonic is SAI. Yeah, Sonic is the operating system.
For SAI, yeah.
For SAI. Sonic, of course, is Microsoft's Azure project that they led and then pushed into the open source. And out of all the open source NOSes, it's the one that seems to be getting the traction, doesn't it? We keep seeing the press releases talk about Sonic. So we may be in a situation where Sonic, SAI, and then anybody's hardware underneath. And it could be Cisco. I didn't get the sense from the blog post that enterprises could buy this product.
It didn't seem enterprise focuses. No, it seemed more like carrier service provider, cloud scale.
Having said that, it is in the data center blog.
Well, they have data centers, I guess.
Yeah, I got the sense this was more for, you know, they talked about it being at the Cisco booth at the Telecom Infrastructure Project Summit that was in London this week, you know, if you wanted to come and see it. So that was what sort of made me think about it as being a cloud thing. So maybe data center, cloud networking, not service provider, but maybe service provider, yeah. The Nexus 9300 does sit inside of the enterprise infrastructure team. And of course, now that Cisco doesn't have separate BUs in the enterprise, all of the enterprise is one BU. You know, so like enterprise WAN, enterprise data center, enterprise campus is all one business unit instead of being, used to be nine of them for just those three. Now there's just one for all of them, which is good.
It is interesting to see how far this white box movement has come, that it's even managed to dislodge Cisco from its stance that integrated software and hardware is the way to go and the only way to go.
Well, I don't want to overstate this. This is one switch, right?
Well, yeah, of course. Yes, it's not like they've got religion, but clearly market forces are compelling them to dip a toe in the water.
I think, and we know that Cisco, you know, we know that Cisco has not been invited to participate in the mega clouds, but there's still a bunch of second tier clouds who would probably prefer to do business with Cisco than not. And you know, we've seen the supply chain arguments go up, and I think all of the vendors will be rubbing their hands together and talking big about their supply chain capabilities and making claims, and fairly unsubstantiated claims, I might add, about how good their supply chain is and the integrity, and that, you know, we do our best to make sure hardware implants don't happen, which is, you know, almost unprovable because you can't go and audit any of these things and you can't go and see the factories and you can't.
It's not feasible to take apart every single box that comes into your shop to check it for implants. It's just.
No, although AWS does. So the big cloud companies actually do. So when the gear comes in that does go through a hardware validation don't do every box, as you say, but they do test them all.
I'm sure they do some statistically significant number of checks, yes. But again, AWS and the others are their own beasts, not your typical enterprise.
Yeah, I'm hopeful. I'm planning a podcast at the moment to talk about Intel TXT and secure execution environments and how hardware integrity can happen. And hopefully we'll get this off the ground with some professional developers who've actually been working in this space in the hardware, software, and how you have secure boot and keep hardware implants going, like how you prevent hardware implants. So hopefully that project will come off and we'll be able to have a podcast for you to listen on that. And then you can make your own decisions about whether claim, you know, provider claims around supply chain integrity are a big thing. But, you know, that might be the feature that Cisco can have. They can say, we've got a much stronger supply chain, therefore you shouldn't be buying white box.
Never miss a marketing opportunity.
Yeah, that's right. Never miss a value add that actually doesn't cost you anything.
Right. Yeah, for sure. All right, let's move on. Last week, Arista Networks announced a campus version of CloudVision. That's their management software for data centers. Arista's new campus version is the company's first step to integrating Mojo Networks, which you may remember is a WLAN vendor that Arista acquired back in August of 2018.
It was always obvious to me that Arista was never going to just produce switches with spanning tree in them and say, here, you can replace those old switches with ours. They're not going to compete on the old standards. They're going to compete on software-driven networks. You know, there's no point in building a product strategy around a 25-year-old spanning tree protocol and MLAG and fat trees, really. It's much more proactive to get in there and say, we can replace your old network with this new amazing cloud vision strategy and pitch it against Cisco's SD access strategy that we've seen so much about. And customers seem to be very strongly reacting to. The stories I've heard is that Cisco sales reps are pushing very hard on SD access, not unsurprising, because whenever Cisco gets this announcement, it does get out the special financially powered whip, in the form of incentives for salespeople to sell SD access, even when customers don't want it, which is also another story that I've heard. Be aware that this will be a software defined. You will need to have the cloud vision to be able to do it. But the unique thing here, of course, is that they're integrating the Mojo, which is the Wi-Fi acquisition, with Arista's Ethernet switches. The thing that's missing, I think, is low-cost campus.
Right. They don't have that yet. They announced earlier this year campus core, what they call spline switches, which I hate that term. But anyway, they do have two campus core switches. They don't have the access layer yet. I assume that's going to be forthcoming. But for now, the Mojo APs, which are now branded Arista APs, do still work with third-party switches. So, but I presume if Arista is really going after the campus, then yes, a campus access switch should be coming.
Yeah, there has to be that, because you can't take these data center switches with the expensive ASICs and all of the expensive power supplies and all that sort of stuff and put them into the campus.
No one's going to put, yeah, you can't afford that.
But on the other hand, Cisco Arista doesn't want to wait. They need to be out there saying, we've got campus, come and look at us, think of us for Wi-Fi. And with the reasonable expectation that nobody's going to buy things and start training up their own sales force, start getting the customers, you know, with the idea that Arista's entering the campus, even though you haven't got products to sell them. That's pretty traditional in enterprise IT. Having a product is optional. Having a strategy that you can send the sales force out with is more important. So don't rush into this. And equally, again, talking to people this week, because I've been out in the field, again, at conferences, talking to people, is Cisco's SD access is probably not fully baked yet, shall we say. There's still plenty of room for improvement operationally, shall we say.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, all of these campus sort of fabric automated systems are still a work in progress, but Arista is definitely making sure that they're letting you know, yes, we're moving in that direction as well. Although I should say that Mojo Networks, they've got some cool technology. They add an extra third radio into all their APs so they can do wireless intrusion prevention and some, you know, RF health automated healing and monitoring. It's a controller-based infrastructure, cloud-managed, all that good stuff. But they don't have a network access control solution like a Cisco ICE or an Aruba ClearPass yet, so that is probably also on the roadmap.
Yeah, well, Cisco ICE, as I said, or Duo Security, I think Duo Security will replace ICE in the longer term. So I imagine that Arista would be out looking at whether they build one or buy one of those. It seems likely that you have to have one. I think increasingly the identity management is also going to be important in the SD-WAN. So once you can extend micro-segmentation to the edge and your edge device can do, you know, micro-segmentation and application recognition, what you really want then is the identity system. And then from a vendor point of view, you've completely locked the customer in. You've got their identity system integrated with the SD-WAN, integrated with the campus. So whenever anything connects, the ID system hangs it. It's connected to the network then reacts, and then all the way through to the data center. So you also have identity management controlling which servers, which VMs, which containers can be on the network. And then you've actually got a security system that looks just like a public cloud.
Hey, how about that?
How about that? So that's a fairly obvious transition as we go forward. So I think you'll see a lot more of that vision if you were to engage with the salespeople and waste time in meetings face-to-face instead of just reading research and white papers, then I think you'd come to the same conclusions.
That's right. All right, moving on. Greg, you were actually at a WAN summit in London this last week, and you have a significant number of observations here.
Yeah, I think there's a few things. This was a WAN summit, so it's just talking about WAN. It is a conference, a paid-for conference, and I went down as a guest on the media thing. And I thought there was a few things. So I've made 5 points here that I wanted to raise that sort of provoked some reaction in me. I was on a panel, and many of the people there were actually MSPs. So quite often with these panels, they put sponsors on there, and then they put one analyst on the end.
You're a token analyst.
Yeah, the token analyst who's supposedly independent, who basically agrees with all the people on the panel because that's where his money comes from, his or her money comes from. And that's not me.
That's right. If you're looking for agreement, don't go with Mr. Farrow.
Yeah, but it was very popular. We had a lot of fun. We did provoke some good discussion, and people actually enjoyed it. I think they did come up and say nice things afterwards. So this is a point to give a shout out to all the people who came up and said hi. You were incredibly generous, and it was so good to talk to you all. So many people came up and said, yeah, I listened to your show, and it's, you know, just wanted to meet you in that. So thanks very much for that. I really appreciate it. It's always nice to see real people instead of just this microphone with a foam thing on the end.
And you actually have no evidence that I'm not just a computer, right?
I've got photos. So one of the interesting subjects that came up was subscription licensing of equipment. So we've seen Cisco very quickly pick up on subscription licensing. It's not overly popular. Customers don't really want it. And for Cisco, of course, it's a financial incentive for their shareholders so they can say that they're a cloud company. Subscriptions equals cloud to most financial people. But I think subscription licensing is going to drive a substantial change in the way customers attach to telcos. If you're going to be raising a PO every year for your routers and your switches and your firewalls and things like that, you're not going to sign up for a five-year WAN contract. You're going to want a one-year WAN contract so that if something changes at that site and I can turn off that license, then I'm going to want to turn off the bandwidth. And I think there's a whole bunch of impacts about that. Everybody next to me went, oh, you know, we don't sign five-year contracts. Mostly it's sort of 3 years these days. I'm going, like, no one's going to sign up for a three-year contract either. You know, when they bring in those MPLS POPs, you know, you bring in a circuit and you're paying like $20,000 to install that. Customers don't want to do that anymore. I think that's going to become much more of a thing as subscription revenue comes in.
So you're saying that instead of getting locked into a long-term contract, customers are going to want something more flexible so they can change providers as needed if a better deal comes along.
If a better deal comes along, they're not going to sign up for 3 year, 5 year, or 5+5 WAN bandwidth contracts. And they're also not going to want to pay a lot of money for it. And I do think, yes, they're right, that once you are at a 12-month agreement to buy bandwidth, you are also in a position to churn. And of course, SD-WAN does actually create the possibility to switch providers very quickly at will.
Yeah, that's the linchpin here, because they make it easy to you can go internet, you can go LTE 5G once that comes along, or just pick another MPLS provider.
Yes, but I also think raising a purchase order every year for your Cisco licenses or your software licenses or your cloud company, you know, you're paying every year for your cloud service for your SD-WAN controller, will start you thinking in terms of 12-month cycle around bandwidth as well, bandwidth contracts. That could drive some really substantially different things, because quite often the telcos rely on five-year contracts and an ROI that takes 2 or 3 years. They amortize various costs on the assumption that they'll make that much revenue. You know, that will change the way bandwidth is pricing, probably for the negative, because if you've got to pay $15,000 to bring in an MPLS tail, you know, bring in the port, well, maybe a broadband connection starts to look pretty sexy.
Yeah.
Right. Instead of they discount the port price normally to help you buy it and then build it into the subscription price. There was a user presentation, a gentleman from a law firm. I don't want to quote him out of context, so I won't put his name up there. But he was talking about his SD-WAN deployment, and it's a largish sort of a law firm. They've got branches sort of globally distributed around the world, including restricted companies. Particularly, he was talking about China and Azerbaijan and how he managed to get the SD-WAN to work there. It's not that it doesn't work. He said there's just some things that you had to go through. They were early adopters, so they started in 2016. Now in 2018, he says the pain has definitely been worth it because it's still better than what they had before. Far, far better, he said, and everybody's pretty happy about it. So I spoke to one of the things that he said during the session, this was actually like I was guffawing out really out loud. He said he has a bunch of Cisco-trained network engineers, and they refused to work on the project because they said it was going to fail. They literally refused. So these are all Cisco-trained or certified people, and they said, no, we're only going to work on Cisco. And this is never going to work. So he actually built another team to roll out the SD-WAN using, in this case, I think he said he uses Silverpeak. And 1 year later, after its success, the in-house network engineers will admit that it does work, but even now, only a few of them will actually work on it or touch it. They're just not interested.
Huh.
Which is extraordinary, right? I think I'm going to follow this up and try and see if we can get him on a show to talk some more about that. But this sort of leads me to the conclusion, to speculate, like the power of Cisco's training programs over the years has been to close engineers' minds around the Cisco solution to see all of their networking in terms of what Cisco's doing. But the flip side of this is once they're loyal to Cisco, while they may be loyal to Cisco, they also don't want to change. They see what they were taught as the beginning and the end, the alpha and the omega. The training program that Cisco has doesn't seem to have encouraged people to think for themselves and to keep changing over time. And if that's true, Cisco's going to have troubles upgrading people to Viptela.
Well, maybe if it comes in with a Cisco box, they might be open to it. But yeah, I would love to hear more about that, whether they had like technical reservations in terms of, you know, technically this doesn't sound like it could work, or it's just like we're uncomfortable with whatever and just aren't interested. That would be a fascinating conversation.
It was, but the whole intimation was the Cisco engineers didn't want to work on not Cisco, which is, you know, and if you want to make that career choice, well, you know, that may be okay, but they also didn't want to move to GUI and cloud and all this other stuff. So it would be interesting to know more about the actual motivation.
Yeah, for sure.
What's also clear is that there's now, like, I met some more new SD-WAN vendors there.
So oh, no.
Ones you haven't heard from. Open Systems, Fortinet was there. There was a bunch of, three or four more. And chatting to various executives and marketing people, they were talking there's over 70 SD-WAN vendors in the market now. But what's also becoming clear is there's a much more diversity in their approaches. So we've talked earlier about how I think SD-WAN is going to be a multi-sided market. And because these SD-WAN appliances sit at the edge of the network, and the overlays don't care about the core. It doesn't care if you're attached to MPLS, you know, Ethernet services of guaranteed bandwidth, or whether you're using MPLS or broadband or direct inbound internet access or 4G. It doesn't really matter. Another thing, I was chatting to somebody and I said, well, why don't you, we're throwing up various problems. And I said, well, why don't you just run two SD-WANs? Why don't you run this SD-WAN vendor for this part of your problem space and run a different one? And he went, oh, well, I wouldn't want to run two networks. I said, well, why not? They're all quite easy to manage because the cloud controllers make them reasonably straightforward. And he sort of went, and we sort of noodled on that for a while. It was like the realization is that actually, yes, you could run multiple SD-WAN overlays without too much pain if your problem space is actually two different problems that can't be resolved with one product. Does that make sense?
It does make sense, and also makes me wonder if there's a market opportunity for a controller of controllers to a software-defined WAN manager to manage all your SD-WAN deployments.
Well, if everything, like, you know, we've seen in the data center space that some people are actually choosing ACI and NSX. They're running two SDN packages in the data center, right? Why not do it in the SD-WAN? If you've got two, and it's only an overlay, right? It's not like you have to change everything.
I think your point is well taken, that if it really is as easy to use as they say, the management is all cloud-based, zero-touch provisioning, simple to set up and deploy. Yeah, if you're working in two consoles, it's really, you know, it certainly seems feasible.
Right. So maybe you've got a high-security part of your organization, and so you want to have, there are SD-WAN products out there that run NFV, and they build in firewalls and intrusion detection and threat management systems into the device itself, and focus on these high security functionalities. And then there's a range of SD-WAN vendors who are focused on high speed WAN acceleration. You know, there's other vendors who are just focused on basic connectivity and the price is matching that. Maybe for some part of your network, you just want a low cost SD-WAN that you'll actually use, you know, whatever bandwidth's available. And as long as it's connected, thumbs up.
And there's some who have their own private networks and maybe they've got capacity or capability in some region that you really need to be in. Yeah, there's a lot of reasons why you might want to do it.
Well, the model that I had in mind is maybe you've got a business unit in your company, which is a high security military type environment. Well, you want to use the high security SD-WAN for that. But there's another part of your company, which is doing retail, right? There's big companies out there who actually have different businesses that do different things, right?
This is our bioweapons division, and this is our men's cargo pants division.
Yeah. This is our lollies. We make lollies over here, but this is bioweapons and sugar lollies. That's about the same thing these days.
Pretty much.
So I that was just something to think about. It's not that it would obviously be desirable to just have one technology, but, you know, we've seen how unsuccessful it has been to try and build one network out of IP routers. So maybe there's a thing to be said. Let's build networks that are customized for the use case. Just an idea at this point in time. So the next thing I wanted to have a good guffaw at was there was a short presentation from the Metro Ethernet Forum, or the MEF. Now, the MEF has obviously been involved in building Metro Ethernet with the telcos and the service providers, and they've been having a sort of a thing. But they were on stage saying, basically begging for enterprises to engage with them. My initial thing was, well, you know, why? Have you run out of service providers? Or are the service providers not engaging with you anymore or something? But basically, you know, and are they following this? We love the enterprise trend because service providers aren't, you know, right. Seeing that, you know, Cisco and Juniper and all the other service provider companies turn back to the enterprise and start revitalizing those initiatives. The flip side was that I didn't see what the MEF was offering to the enterprises. Like, the MEF is a very odd organization. It's very niche. It's very insular. And he sort of said, well, you know, we've got these standards and we'd love to get some input from the enterprise. And I was just looking at his pitch going like, and what do I get out of it?
That was my first question. Yeah, what does an enterprise get out of engaging with the Metro Ethernet Forum?
Yeah, like, why do I care about NFV functionalities and defining APIs? And personally, I think NFV is a load of bunk. The idea that a telco can provide 1,000 customers with 1,000 unique solutions, like, you know, configure the firewalls. I mean, these guys haven't even been able to run one network for 1,000 customers reliably and stably at a reasonable price. The idea that they're going to have 1,000 customers running firewalls and accelerators and antivirus scanning engines and all these ranges of NFV services that they want to offer us and then customize them at a viable level is just laughable to me. I mean, I'll suspend belief if they say they can definitely do it. But the idea that my service provider can configure a firewall because they know what websites are is just not something I can imagine.
Right. Right. Well, this maybe creates some room for the MSPs then.
Yeah, well, the managed service providers were pretty interesting. They were on the panel. And obviously, managed service providers don't want to see SD-WANs replace their outsourcing contracts.
Sure, of course.
Yeah, which was pretty interesting. But the thing that I noted from all of the NSPs is they're sort of treating bandwidth as like this treasure, like diamonds. Like, oh, you have to be very careful not to use too much of it. You know, you have to be very careful so it's all conserved and that, you know, you've got costs and costs. And I'm going like, that's bunk. That's absolute bunk. Bandwidth is like, it's just like air. It's available to anybody who wants it. There was a presentation from the telegeography guys comparing dedicated MPLS services to internet services provided over MPLS tails. Well, that's a false comparison. Where's the broadband? Where's the low-cost Ethernet services? Where's 4G, right? It just like bandwidth in capital city. Now, don't get me wrong. There are definitely towns and cities where bandwidth is limited. And you have to come to terms with the fact that, you know, bandwidth may actually be a treasure in those places because nobody's invested in, you know, building out the DWDM rings or the backbones for that. And as one of the people said, they said that word T1 is still quite common in America. Mm. And that's true outside of the certain.
Yes, that is true.
So, but, you know, if you've got a network that's in London, Amsterdam, and New York, you can buy 10 gig tails for like $1,000 a month. Why would you? You don't need to preserve this bandwidth. You should be wasting it, you know. I had a really good discussion with somebody and they're going like, I said, well, have you thought about just using 4G? And he said, well, 4G is really expensive. I'm going like what? Your $1,500 a month MPLS connection is cheap? Like, right. You know, how much bandwidth could you buy on a 4G for $1,500 a month? And the look on his face was pretty priceless. And then I pointed out that you can have like four of them, have four different 4Gs. I said, statistically, the chance that all four of your 4G providers are down at any given point in time is pretty low.
Yeah.
Like, be pretty close to like four nines. You wouldn't have any of the provisioning times. You'd have no contracts. You'd be able to walk away. There's definite advantages into that. And yet none of the MSPs were talking about that, of course, because they were all MSPs who have networks to sell.
That's right.
So do be careful when you listen to these. Keep your mind open. Anyway, so they're the 5 points that I sort of walked away from the WAN summit. A lot of these people that are framing the SD-WAN discussion are often people who have an existing business that they want to extend, or sometimes it's actually just lack of awareness. Like, if your whole job is selling MPLS bandwidth for the last 30 years, you're actually not thinking about selling customer service that doesn't use MPLS bandwidth.
Yep.
They just haven't even thought of it, right? They're just stuck in the same old ways.
Yeah, the takeaway I'm getting here is that, and I think we've been talking about it for a long time, is that SD-WAN creates a whole bunch of new opportunities, a whole bunch of new ways to think about how you're getting bandwidth, how you're provisioning services for end users. And so take a little time, think about it. And you've got options now more than you ever have before when it comes to the WAN.
It's not like your whole network has to be SD-WAN. Right. Right. If you've got a network in Kazakhstan that you can't change, don't change it. Just right. leave it IP That's routed right. and move right along. You know, don't put an SD-WAN there. It's not like you have to.
That's right. All right. Well, we've got some more news to come coming for you, but just a quick break to tell you about our sponsor today, VMware. You can immerse yourself in the future of networking tech by attending VMware's Virtual Cloud Network Deep Dive event, and it's coming to a city near you. Data and applications are increasingly running at the edges of the network or migrating to the cloud. This hyper-distribution places new demands on enterprise networks and on the underlying physical infrastructure. So you should attend the Virtual Cloud Network Deep Dive and hear from VMware's NSX product experts on how to create an agile, programmable network infrastructure that can meet the business and security demands of the multi-cloud world. It's a half-day interactive session. While you're there, you'll learn how the virtual cloud network delivers a software-defined networking and security architecture. You can deploy it on any switch fabric, including Cisco ACI. It's contextual application-level security via micro-segmentation, new levels of network visibility and real-time analytics without having to re-architect, automation to reduce application and network deployment times, and workload mobility across physical sites or to the public cloud. If you want to find out how to sign up for one of these events, go to vmware.com/go/VCN deep dive. One more time, vmware.com/go/VCN deep dive, and you can register for a deep dive event closest to you.
Yeah, and they're putting events that's going to run through next year, I believe. It's not just today.
Yes, they're going all over the place, North America, I think, and Europe.
Yeah, right now they're in New York in October and then in Toronto, Ontario. So that's the next two, and they're also going to be doing them through next year. So you actually may want to keep an eye on that page so you can register for events as they announce them. So we're going to be doing more ad placements in the months ahead talking about this.
That's right. Roadshow.
Roadshow.
All right, there's a new kid on the software-defined data center block. A startup called Kaloom has officially launched, and it calls itself the industry's first fully automated programmable data center fabric. And I can imagine that folks like VMware, Cisco, Juniper, Big Switch would say, I have some issues with that claim.
Well, I think the unique thing here is they're using P4 as the data plane. Is that right?
They are coming to market saying, build these white boxes on P4 using the Tofino barefoot ASIC, yes. So that you get a programmable fabric and also a programmable data plane.
Which makes me excited, like deep inside.
Deep inside.
Instead of forwarding on MAC address or IP address header, we're actually getting to the real world. We're actually programming the forwarding plane completely. So this is where we wanted to be when we started talking about OpenFlow in 2011. And 7 years later, we're starting to move to where we really want to be, like fully programmable. So instead of just encapsulating in an overlay and then steering flow using VXLAN or NVGRE or, you know, whatever it is your favorite overlay is, this is actually programming the forwarding plane so that hop by hop, it's actually being forwarded. Now, maybe you use P4 to create an overlay, but that's a choice that this product will have. And that's what's unique about this product is this level of flexibility that they've got.
Yeah, they're positioning themselves as obviously programmable down to the data plane, saying that you, obviously with something like P4, you can get new features in place, you know, without having to wait for the merchant silicon to catch up. And you can get super low latency inside the fabric. So for like financial services, gaming, or service providers and carriers looking for low latency applications, that's how they're positioning this fabric.
Yeah, so the P4 thing, of course, means that they can also program and host themselves too. So you can have the right drivers in your Linux and Kubernetes and so forth, and you can actually use P4 to actually extend the network right the way out to the edge. Now, I'm sure they're not doing that yet. You did a briefing on them?
I did a briefing with them, yes. Yeah, they're not at the edge yet as far as I know.
No, but they could be. So as if the product stays around and is successful over time, they could actually be full programming right the way from the edge, from the host all the way across the fabric. This also means telemetry and stuff like that for them would be inherent in the future. I don't think they're doing that now, but as you know, if they can stay the course again, they've got lots of directions they could take this product that would be quite unique. I think this is quite exciting in the sense that it shows the ideas of overlays may actually just be temporary and maybe just a way station on the way forward. It could be that this doesn't work because it doesn't scale or there are things. I'm not willing to make a guess in that direction at the moment.
Yeah, let's not get too excited. P4 and programmable ASICs are still very nascent at this stage, and it's not an easy programming language to work with either. You've got to be very careful in how you're programming an ASIC. So, but the fact that it's there, it's available if you've got the need or the chops in-house to make it work. And P4 applications are coming out. I know Barefoot's got a bunch. I bet they have a telemetry app. To remember, I think they do.
They do, yeah.
And it's an open source language, so other folks are creating applications that take advantage of P4, so you get that benefit.
Yeah, there's quite a few open source projects around using P4 at the edge. And I've also seen some of the smart NIC makers announce P4 extensions for their silicon. So, you know, it's something that people are considering at least.
And some other things that jumped out at me in the briefing, of course, they have their own vRouter software. They're basing it on SnapRoute, on a community edition of SnapRoute routing stack. And they've got a virtual switch, of course, and it's based on the Berkeley Extensible Software Switch. That was the first time I had heard of BESS, Berkeley Extensible Software Switch, so I had to do a little digging on that. It's interesting. I still got to do some reading up on it, but that's something that caught my eye. I don't know if you've heard about Berkeley Extensible Software Switch.
I did read about it a while back. I think it's, and I can't bring it to mind. I'd have to go and read up.
Yeah.
But I think it's in my queue to look carefully at again in about a year's time if it gets over the edge.
I've got a link to some GitHub details on it if you want to go check it out. It's obviously software based. It looks like it's supposed to run on a server, and it's not actually a switch itself, but it's got modules you can put together to develop switching functions. So interesting stuff. So anyway, we're seeing more advances in software-defined data center fabrics, and Kaloom is the latest entrant. All right, moving on. Greg, this is a story you found. The growth of global access to the internet is slowing. This is according to The Guardian, which cites a forthcoming report from the Web Foundation. Growth has fallen from 19% in 2017 to 6% in 2018.
Yeah, this is more of a society issue, I think. The article was actually posted in The Guardian, which is a left-leaning ish sort of mainstream newspaper here in the UK, and they've got some fair amount of traction globally. They're fairly well known for breaking certain stories globally. The point of what they're trying to make here is they've actually gotten to see a report that has been put together by one of the big government agencies, I think one of the UN agencies.
It's a UN agency. The report is coming out of the Web Foundation, which was a foundation created by Tim Berners-Lee. We all know his name. But the report pulls data from this UN report looking at the rollout of internet access all over the world, including third world and emerging countries. Yeah.
And I think what they're saying is particularly in third world and emerging countries is that internet rollout has stopped or slowed dramatically.
So yeah.
It was, you know, back in 2008, you're seeing 15 to 20% growth, and now it's down to 3 or 4%. And the article makes typically left-wing sort of hyperbolic sort of claims that the poor people are losing, et cetera, et cetera. And I also sit in there thinking to myself, the article is also assuming that everyone needs internet to progress and live better lives, which arguably Twitter and Facebook have consistently proven that that's not necessarily true. You know, a lot of these countries having internet access won't help you if you're only living on $2 a day and you don't have clean water and good food. So I just wonder if we've hit a point where the countries that don't have internet literally do not have things like electricity to power 3G base stations.
Yeah, there are a whole lot of issues. I presume that one of the reasons we're seeing the slowdown is that the low-hanging fruit has sort of been taken care of, you know, big city centers, big populations, and that it's harder now to reach more exurban remote villages and places like that, or places where for geopolitical instability reasons or just because of the terrain, very hard to get services out there.
They're comparing Somalia, which has 1.9% of people able to access the internet, to Iceland with 98.2%. Well, Iceland's only 300,000 people live in the entire country.
Right.
And it's the size of a postage stamp. You know,
yes, it's very dense.
Yeah. And last time I checked, they weren't having a civil war.
Right, exactly.
So it's a little bit invidious to start comparing these things. And Somalia doesn't even have too many functional power plants, much less a power transmission network.
Right.
So you can't have internet without power, and you can't have power unless you've got food and water and safety. So I think it's somewhat invidious to just make these generalizations. And so I would take the article to task. But in principle, yes, people's lives would be improved if they could access the internet and get educated. Yes, all of those things are absolutely true. But let's not forget that there's more important things to worry about first for many of these countries.
All right. Well, we've got links if you want to go check it out. Moving on, Apple has launched a new privacy portal where Apple customers can see what data the company collects about them. That includes things like calendar entries, photos, documents, things you've bought through the Apple Store, website bookmarks, and so on. Apple says customers who access this data can correct it if it's inaccurate or, quote, delete the data if Apple is not required to retain it by law or for legitimate business purposes. In other words, if Apple wants to keep it because they feel like they need it, then you don't get to delete it.
Yep. For billing. So you can't delete the fact that you bought an app. They need to keep that billing information for statistics and analytics.
Of course.
Yeah. As always, the law is a very blunt instrument for these things.
Well, I think part of this came up because of GDPR, needing more privacy transparency. But Apple has also marketed itself as a privacy-friendly organization. So this does seem in keeping with their approach to the market.
Well, I think we're also seeing this as a reaction to the general tech lash. So the people who are much better at punditing than me are talking a lot about the tech lash. So we're seeing Facebook squirming as the breaches start to take hold and the government start to take aim at Facebook. Google's breach that we talked a bit about last week. We're seeing all of the people in Silicon Valley suddenly realize that all the damage that they've done to make these mega billions that they've extracted, people are now saying, okay, well, you made these problems, now fix them. And they go like, what? We didn't do it.
It wasn't our fault.
It wasn't. We were just helping. We didn't mean to cause these problems.
We're just
helping people communicate. And so it's going to be interesting to see how the tech lash. So I think this is partly a reaction to that. And also Apple has a competitive position where privacy is key to their strategy. They don't feel the need to make money out of sharing people's personal and private information like Facebook does.
Right.
And to conduct surveillance. They certainly could, but they've chosen not to. And they now believe that to be a feature of their product. And we've seen Tim Cook and on down talk about the value of user privacy and respecting user privacy. But interestingly, what you're starting to see them is say as required by law. And that is a tip of the hat to plaque that Chinese law or Indonesian law is very different to US law, is very different to UK law or European law. I think you're going to see a lot more wording coming out now where they start saying, we have to comply with law in all the world, not just in one world. That's the US.
Yeah, right? That's right.
So they will continue and they draw more revenue from the rest of the world than they do from the US. So they have to be fairly balanced. Just because they pay tax in the US doesn't mean they're necessarily answerable to the US government. And that's also true of Facebook and Google and many other megacorps.
And I will say, I appreciate the fact that Apple is marketing around privacy. I like the fact that they're doing that. I agree that their business model does not depend on exploiting their customer, at least through selling and reselling information. Although if for some reason things change at Apple and their investors want more growth, that business model can always change. So
they could always block Facebook from being on phones. If it really mattered, that's what they
could, you know? I guess they could. That could be a feature.
You could point to them and say, look, you're still culpable because you still let Twitter and Facebook appear on your platform.
I guess.
It's a pretty thin argument in my point of view.
Yeah. Well, here's a story from the opposite end of the privacy spectrum. Amazon recently received a patent on voice analysis technology to determine, quote, physical and emotional characteristics of users. The idea, according to a story in Ars Technica, is for Alexa devices to detect if maybe you have a cold or a sore throat. And then, hey, Alexa could serve up an ad saying, do you want to buy some cough medicine?
So sometimes you look at these patents and you just know that there's an engineer inside and the engineer actually gets a bonus for every patent he can register.
Oh, I'm sure.
And so companies quite often have these. I spoke to one engineer and he said, yeah, like every 3 months, he said they would have a meeting, scheduled meeting, and they'd sit down with lawyers and talk about what they're working on. And then the lawyer would go, we can patent that. We can patent that. No, that can't do that. And then they would go off and make patents. So it's not like these people actually design something and earn patents. Quite often they're just taking ideas of whatever they're just playing around with. And if they can patent it, they will. And so this doesn't necessarily mean that Amazon's going to do this. You know, let Alexa do vocal analysis and listen to tone and, you know, analyze you over time. But it's just an idea. And they're going to patent it for funds because they can.
Well, I think it fits in with their whole business model of making consumption as frictionless as possible, right? If you're sitting on the couch, you've got a cold and you say, Alexa, play me a song. And Alexa's like, oh, sounds like you're congested. You want some decongesting? We can have it there for you in an hour and you get 10% off.
Yeah.
You know, how many people are going to say yes?
Yeah, that's right. Whether you want Amazon knowing that you're depressed so that they can ship you brownies.
Well, that was the other thing. I made up, but they're also looking at emotional state. This patent covers detecting changes in emotional state. They call it emotional abnormalities, which makes me think, yes, this was designed by an engineer who thinks that a deviation from your emotional baseline is an abnormality.
This is going to be great. I can't wait until Amazon's into pharmacies and then also into legal drugs. Like that we've seen the legalization of marijuana.
Absolutely.
Like, Greg, it's like, Greg, I see you're a bit down. Would you like some marijuana or perhaps some serotonin pills to give you a bit of, you know, let me diagnose that for you.
Yeah. and they have bought an online pharmacy called PillPack, and they also own Whole Foods. So yeah, you could get that marijuana brownie delivered to you.
Same day delivery.
Same day.
Provided you're rich.
Well, yeah, that's... Yeah,
provided you're rich enough to A, own an internet connection, B, own an Amazon Prime account, C, own an Amazon... any device that runs an Alexa, and C, have enough training to actually get... But aside from that, no, it's going to help everybody. That's totally. Right. Technology. Yeah.
And not creepy at all.
Not creepy at all. We're just helping.
That's right. Yeah, just sharing. Couple more stories before we wrap it up. SolarWinds, they were going public. They're still going public, but they have dramatically cut the number of shares they're going to offer in their forthcoming IPO from 42 million shares initially down to 25 million.
Yeah, originally this was going to be a big IPO valuing the company at $4.5 billion, I think. And Thoma Bravo and Silver Lake took the company private, thought they could repackage it and run it out for a pretty good profit. They've had it for 3 years. They've had a nice little boost out of it, but they haven't been able to get the IPO to make the big deal. So they've listed it at the bottom of the range, and they're also cutting it back. So that can only be called fail, short of actually like pulling the IPO because it didn't run at all. So they're going to be hoping that once it gets onto the stock market, it will pop in some way. I've not talked about this IPO much because I don't think there's much here. I think SolarWinds is pretty well understood. And while it may well be well entrenched in many organizations, particularly in the SME space, there, you know, everybody's got some SolarWinds somewhere, I'm not sure that it's actually a critical element of people's infrastructure. And maybe the share prices represent that.
Yeah, the IPO was supposed to raise as much as $756 million. Now they're saying it's going to be around $387 million. So that's quite a dip.
Yep. Back to the drawing board.
Got to make that money back some other way. Yeah.
We'll have to. That didn't work out. How are we going to get there? Yeah, so we'll see. They won't be happy, I don't think.
All right, for the last sip, we're head to the world of office fashion. Panasonic has designed a set of human blinders that you can wear in an open office, and you may have seen the photos online. These things look ridiculous.
Like, this is literally like horse blinders, just with a fancy bit of design to make them look
slightly cooler,
make
I guess.
Make you feel less like you're in a 1920s communist movie.
I mean, think about the messing of like, focus on nothing but your work. Put this on your head.
Totally not. And I saw somebody tweet and they said, like, just build offices. Stop using open plan.
Right.
You know,
it's a terrible solution to a bad problem.
Noise canceling headphones and blind, like human blinders to simulate an office.
Right. Just build an office.
Or at least if you're going to have an open plan office, just admit it's cheap, right? And you're cheap and you don't want to build offices, you know? So the last few weeks I've been away and working in a remote office, and this office was so loud. They had concrete floors, concrete walls, and a concrete ceiling, and any noise just echoed around there like you're in the Grand Canyon or something. And it was just unbelievably bad.
Or it's hip, dynamic, and vibrant. It depends on how you position it.
Yeah, and just put some sound deadening panels so that the noise doesn't travel and you'll be halfway to having blinders in the first place. So it's just terrible. Just terrible.
You kids keep that startup down over there. I'm trying to work.
That's pretty much it. Yeah. It was like, even though it was terrible. Anyway, this is a dumb idea. I shouldn't have to wear something on my head so I can't look left or right to get my job done. It's really up to my employer to give me a decent working environment, honestly.
That's right. Home office.
And that involves office and sound deadening. That involves walls and sound deadening material.
Yeah, please. Well, we have the link if you want to go see the picture.
Oh, we've gone a bit long today. Apologies to everybody who's tuned in. I hope it was worthwhile. If it's too long, let us know. That would be really, really great.
Yeah, we did go long. We'll wrap it up. But if people can't get enough, Greg, how can they find you online?
You can follow me tweeting out my little snippets of thought and snark all week on at Ethereal Mind. That's ethereal mind. And I'm also picking up my blogging activities on the packetpushers.net/blogs, where I'll be dropping little notes. I've got a bunch of research papers that I've got to read. And as I read them, I'll try and do some short summaries of them and then link to them so that you can get to them and enjoy them as well.
Fantastic. I'm Drew Conry-Murray. I'm on Twitter at Drew_CM. I blog at packetpushers.net. Thank you to VMware for sponsoring this episode. And of course, thank you for always listening. You know where to find us, packetpushers.net. You can also check out our membership site, ignition.packetpushers.net. And as always, thanks for listening.